there was to look at the kinetic transport chiral, for states of the chiral superfield, which comes from Keller potential. We determine the dimension of the superfield, and then we use the dimension from this kinetic scaling to ask what are renormalizable. Interactions in nonlinear sigma model. And so the answer to that question happened to be that it is a Vesemino model. So Vesemino model in this kinetic scaling contains all possible renormalizable interactions. But then we were facing a problem, okay? And the problem was how can we think about nonlinear sigma model in general? Okay, so nonlinear sigma model scaling in general. And the issue there is that in this nonlinear sigma model, so if we write down the superpotential, so the superpotential is an expansion over all possible powers of chiral superfield. And so in principle, there is infinite number of terms. And so what we will obtain, once we write down the potential, we will obtain non-renormalizable interactions. And so what this means that the only way we can think about a nonlinear sigma model as an effective field theory, nonlinear sigma model must be an effective field theory. Okay? And so because it's an effective field theory, it's valid at very low energy scales. And so in particular, it should be a nonlinear sigma model should help us understand the vacuum properties of our theory, vacuum properties. Because when we talk about the vacuum, we talk about zero energy states if the supersymmetry is unbroken. Now, what we will see in some explicit examples, that when we ask the question, what are the vacuum properties of supersymmetric quantum field theory, to the first approximation, kinetic term doesn't matter much. And so, so then all this kinetic scaling idea of how we determine scaling dimension just goes down the drain. Okay? And so there must be something else. So if we study vacuum properties, then kinetic terms shouldn't matter, right? So I'm just asking the question: what is the ground state of my theory? No interactions and no fluctuations whatsoever. So it's incorrect to try to make some statements using kinetic scaling. Okay. Again, we will be more precise about that in a little bit, because the result is a fine print. What do I mean? Okay. So how do we proceed in nonlinear sigma model? So what we're going to do, we're going to say that once we talk about the vacuum, so then to begin with, we're thinking about allowing our effective field theory to browse all possible configuration space. Very much like our last discussion about landscape of string theory, we should allow our field to explore all possible vacua. And if we do that, then if we think that that's something that can change arbitrarily, then that implies that we should assign a scaling dimension of zero to a chiral superfield. Okay, so this is dimensionless assignment. Right, so I cannot make sense of allowing anything to vary if it has dimensions. right? So the battery be dimensionless. Again, everything will be very clear. It's a little bit not clear for now, but we'll do some example where things will get back into its place. But let's see what this means. Once we said that our we assign by hand a scaling dimension of zero to all cardinal superfields, then this immediately implies in superpotential, the scaling dimensions of all couplings is three. Okay, so all couplings are equally important. All couplings are equally important. And so you cannot just sort of truncate by hand the superpotential, this infinite series, okay? Which is, again, something that you might expect should have happened, given that by assigning a zero scaling dimension, you allow the system to explore any possible values. And so it better be that the answer that you will get should be sensitive about the behavior of the superpotential anywhere in the field space. And that actually is something that we already see here. Now, if we do that, then in calipotential, all terms has couplings, and the number of if we have derivatives as well, all terms have scaling dimension plus two. Okay, because a scaling dimension of calipotential is two, and the scaling dimension of the superpotential, remember, is three. So we will see an explicit example why I made these statements. Okay, so the net terms should not matter. So we will actually see it in some very simple examples that I'm doing right now, but that's indeed the case. Okay, so here comes an example. Okay. So the example of the model that we will look at. So for now, it has nothing to do with supersymmetry, but the generalization will be obvious once we understand this model for supersymmetry. So we'll look at a model which has this Lagrangian, minus 1/2, del mu phi. And then I have a potential V of phi. So the problem is that now my V of phi is not something I would write down for having normalized quantum field theory, but rather it takes this form, it's phi squared. And then I have plus lambda phi to the A. Okay? And so in a way of writing this Lagrangian, I choose m squared to be positive and lambda being positive. So you see a bunch of unusual features already in this simple model. First of all, I have a wrong sign for the mass, right? So my field is not a normal particle, it's a vector. So it's an instability. And then I have an interaction which contains a very high power of phi. And so if we were to use, kinetic scaling, right? So again, to make our life simple, I use a simple kinetic term. So that would imply that my scalar field has in a kinetic scaling dimension 1. So that would mean that lambda has a scaling dimension minus 4. Because the scaling dimension of a Lagrangian, remember, must be equal to plus 4. And that's one of the couplings has negative mass dimension, so this theory is non-normalized. Okay. So the way to think about this is really in terms of effective field theory. And So let me just tell you, so this, what I call this dimensionless assignment, this is also called vacuum scaling, meaning that we do this scaling if we don't know a priori where the vacuum of the system is, and we just try to figure it out. So So let's, I still didn't answer you the question why the kinetic scaling is wrong here, and why it is a wrong idea thinking about kinetic scaling here. I will do it, but after we will explore the vacuum scale. Okay? So in vacuum scaling, so we do vacuum scaling. Well, in order for me to make sense of a vacuum scaling, I need to make my field, wherever is a field in my Lagrangian dimensions. So the way how I can do it, I can still not hide away from the side that if I am to compute the dimension, this bar has dimension 1, plus 1. So I need to introduce a new field by half, which will be a dimensionless. And so the only way I can make it dimensionless by introducing a scale in my problem. So the necessity of the scale is dictated, is imposed on me, because I cannot think of that as quantum field theory. This can only be an effective field theory. And so there must be a scale already there that will tell me that I better not ask questions about the scale. So this is a cutoff scale of effective field theory. Okay? So if I do that, then it's a trivial exercise to rewrite the Lagrangian in terms of this new dimensionless field phi. Right? So phi hat is equal to 0, and that's how the field in the vacuum scaling, the one that we said there, could be applicable later when we look at the nonlinear signal model. Lambda to the A, phi hat to the A. Okay, so I will have something like that. So the first observation is something that I already mentioned here, that once we do this vacuum scaling, all terms in the potential, well, here it was a super potential, so in our toy model, it is potential are equally important. And indeed, you can see this, that the mass dimension of this coupling, m squared, lambda squared, the mass dimension of this is plus 4. The mass dimension of lambda, lambda to the 8, is minus 4 plus 8 equals to 4. So all the couplings have the same scaling dimension, so they are important. So now, in which sense, we can actually now address the question that guy said there, kinetic terms should not match. Okay? So, so for the vacuum scaling, you look for the vacuum of the theory. So what is the property of the vacuum? So when we talk about the vacuum of the theory, we think about the expectation value of our scalar field. And we think about simplest vacuum. And simplest vacuum have a property that this expectation value is constant. So what I'm trying to say is that in vacuum, strictly speaking, phi hat is a constant. It's a homogeneous configuration, homogeneous and static configuration. And now, of course, studying just vacuum would be completely boring. So what we would be doing is studying small fluctuations around the vacuum. So what I would like to say is that so field phi, I will ask the question, what will happen if I study small fluctuation of this field phi hat? So it's some constant, I don't know, we call it phi naught, right? And then I have a profile, I omega minus I ks, right? Something like that, a profile of the field. And then let me look at different terms in this Lagrangian. So I want to know is if I evaluate a Lagrangian, which terms are important for small, right? So I'm assuming that k squared is small, right? Small. So there, so this is an invariant. So k squared is minus omega squared plus k vector squared, right? So small compared to what, right? In the effective field theory, we have our scale, capital lambda, And so k squared is much, must be much less than lambda squared. So that's what I mean by small fluctuations. Now, once I said this, I can look at different terms in my Lagrangian. So the first term involves two derivatives. And so it will be lambda squared times k squared, right? So the other term will be m squared lambda squared, right? So, so phi hat is, I'm not writing down this constant here. And then there is the last term, which is lambda to the a, okay? So what this tells me that in the limit as k squared over lambda squared goes to zero, and k squared over m squared also goes to zero. So I'm looking at the fluctuations, which are very, very long wavelengths, very small frequency compared to any other scale in my model, then you can explicitly see that this term becomes a dominant. All the other terms in the Lagrangian doesn't have k dependence. And so in the limit of long wavelengths or low energies, so this is the limit of low energy, indeed, what you see is that kinetic terms are not important. This is what I was promising you. Okay, good. So now we can answer the following. Now we can answer the next question. So the next question is, why is it bad even to think about kinetic scaling, right? Why couldn't we do a kinetic scaling in this model? Well, the reason is simple. So if you think what kinetic scaling implies that, so kinetic scaling implies that phi, expectation value of phi is close to zero. So we look at the fluctuations of the field in our quantum field theory, and we don't go far away from the place where this field is displaced too much. But in the model that we are looking right now, that is precisely the secret limit, right? So for small values of phi, my potential starts like this, right? Mu phi, and this is the field phi. So kinetic scaling actually focuses on this vacuum of the theory. So this is kinetic scaling will focus up here, but that's a nonsensical theory. I cannot make sense of this theory at all. I cannot write down a nice stable quantum fluctuations, I cannot quantize those small fluctuations. So rather, what the vacuum scaling tells us, the vacuum scaling tells us, forget about the kinetic term, and rather think about potential to begin with, but you cannot truncate the potential at all. You need to keep all the terms. And so this is, if we keep all the terms, our potential will be like this. So it indeed will start echelonic, but then lambda phi to the a term will take over. So this is a full potential. And then what the vacuum structure, vacuum scaling tells us is that explore the whole configuration space and find the stable vacuum, okay? So, yeah, sure, we can do that. And so when we look for the vacuum, so we have to find the extrema, so d prime of phi must vanish at the vacuum, and we can actually easily evaluate it. So I'm going to call this when phi equals phi vacuum, so we have plus a lambda phi vacuum to the seventh is equal to zero. So there are two solutions. One is this unstable point, but then there is another stable point, and it's plus or minus m squared over 8 lambda to the power of 1/6. Okay? So you can see the way how you have to think about effective field theory. Once you have an effective field theory, you look at the potential of this effective field theory, and you first find the stable vacuum. You forget about kinetic term, you find the stable vacuum. In this case, we have this nice feature that symmetry of the theory is spontaneously broken. Right, so we still have this global symmetry, but it's spontaneously broken. But then you can say, okay, so how can we do a particle physics with that? Well, the answer is also quite simple. Once you understood what the stable vacuum of the theory is, what we have to do, we have to study small fluctuations around that vacuum. See, the kinetic scaling would focus us up here, and kinetic scaling always focuses, as I said, when the field has a displacement close to zero. So rather, but we need to use kinetic scaling in order to study the quantization of fluctuations. Well, the difference is to study the fluctuations of the system. So what we're going to do, we're going to redefine our field. We're going to displace into a stable vacuum, and then write down a new field H. And then if we want to study the interactions around the vacuum, we will use kinetic scaling for this field. Okay? But whenever I said I'm going to use a kinetic scaling, it's actually an implicit assumption that I'm going to study small fluctuations when the field is displaced by small amount from the true vacuum. Right? So this is my vacuum. And those fluctuations will be described by a field H. And in order for me to study these fluctuations, which I should be able to quantize and make sense of some nice quantum field theory, again, I have to keep in mind that this my quantum field theory will be valid below this cutoff scale lambda, but I need to do this shift of the field. Yes.
I think they should be all root of like all six root of.
No, so if I restrict only to real fields. Around the two.
Okay.
Yes, we have, it's not Carroll superfield here, just normal field. Okay, so as I said, it's a small displacement. Once we have small displacement, then we shift our field. And then we ask the question, so how does interactions are being described in this new vacuum. So I need to compute an effective potential for the field H, assuming that it's a small displacement. Well, there will be a cosmological constant here. Okay. So again, this is a trivial computation because all I have to do is just substitute the shift in the total potential. There will be a mass term for the field, right? So it's a positive mass term, which is an indication that we are in a stable vacuum. So my field H has a positive fluctuation. And then there will be an interaction. There will be a cubic interaction, H cube. And then there will be a quartic interaction, 70 lambda phi vacuum to the fourth, H to the fourth. And then the series doesn't end. So there will be H to the fifth, and so on. But if I am now a particle theorist, once I figured what is my vacuum, then I would like to study interactions or self-interactions of my field, then I would restrict my effective potential just to renormalizable terms. Okay? And then this theory is completely well defined. Once I use a kinetic scaling, it has only renormalizable interaction. And so I can start computing whatever I want to compute, scattering amplitudes, correlation functions, and so on. Again, the only thing I have to keep in mind is that this expansion is valid whenever my field H is much less than phi vacuum. Okay, so the displacement are much less than that. And I also have to keep in mind that even though Even though technically this theory is well defined up to infinitely high energy, extending it to infinitely high energy is the incorrect thing to do. So I still have to restrict, in whatever processes I do, I have to restrict that the momenta is much less than the cutoff scale. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
What's the justification for H and higher terms?
Just because they are higher order in the approximation, absolute value of H is much less than the vacuum expectation value. So again, I'm just saying that if I just use these four terms here, my theory formally is valid up to any energy scale. But then I have to ask exactly the question that you asked, why can I ignore this term? And so being able to ignore this term means this condition. And then actually there is one more condition that we have to remember, that this is just an effective field theory. So I can, even though strictly speaking, I can study technically a scattering at an infinite energy, it doesn't make sense. So there is a cutoff scale. Because the theory that I started with is a non-renormalizable theory, is just an effective field theory. And so this is a way how we make sense of the effective field theories in physics in general. After we choose a stable vacuum, we study small fluctuations in that vacuum and we quantize them. Study a normalizable interaction. In principle, I can keep more terms. And again, it will be small, it will be small corrections. In this model, it will be a controllable correction. Yes.
How did you get the effective?
The effective, I just choose the V that I started with and substitute instead of phi vacuum plus H. And the phi vacuum, I know what it is. It is a sixth root. And then I plug it all in Mako and ask it to do the series extension in H. And then I type in the end. Provided I didn't make the mistake, but again, this is Mako. And I'll do it. All right, guys, so, but let's think what it tells us. It tells us all this simple example, it tells us a very nice and powerful story. And it also tells us how should we think about, in particular, it tells us how we should think about nonlinear system models. So it tells us that in nonlinear simple model, the only important thing is the super potential. Okay? So whatever the Kiala potential is, it doesn't matter really much. And moreover, when we later study small fluctuations around the vacuum, we can use classical kinetics. Well, we have to be careful here, but most of the time, and this is what people do when they study phenomenology coming from effective field theory, classical kinetic term, classical, in this case, Kiala potential. All right? So why this is so important? Because what we're going to do now with you, we can prove a theorem. Again, the proof is simple enough that after I show you the example, you can do the proof yourself. But what we will show is that in supersymmetric, intrusive quantum field series, superpotential W does not receive perturbative quantum corrections. Well, actually, I should say quantum corrections at all. In other words, whatever you have for a superpotential classically, quantum mechanically is the same. So this is known as another normalization theorem for superpotential in supersymmetric field theories. As surprising as it sounds, it's actually quite simple. And so what we're going to do, we're going to derive this in some example, and then it will be clear why it's so general. So by the way, the people who did that were Leiber. So Nate Leiber actually explained it using pretty much the language that I'm going to use, following Philip of Jiros, who followed him. And but at the end of the day, some people can be skeptical. And they say, oh, you're making a very strong statement. You're telling us that the interactions doesn't receive quantum correction, so we're still going to go and do through computations. Well, people did do that, and they found the answer that we can establish without doing any computation whatsoever. So the statement has been checked, at least during perturbation theory, and it was a surprise, actually. But then, once Zybert explained what was going on, then it became clear that it must have been like that. But I want to tell you that this is very crucial, because you can see that it is a superpotential that will determine the vacuum properties of the theory. So in other words, when we talk about vacua, why people put so much emphasis on the supersymmetry? Because if you don't have a supersymmetry and you choose a vacuum, so your vacuum might receive quantum corrections, okay? And you don't know whether it will be your vacuum after the quantum correction. So what you do know is that if supersymmetry is unbroken, and it's a big if, because we all know that supersymmetry can be spontaneously broken. So if the supersymmetry is unbroken, then whatever the vacuum you find classically, those are the same vacuums that will inspire quantum mechanics. Okay. So classical vacuum survive quantum correction. And so in order to do that, we come to a new topic, which is selection rules and non-minimalization theorem, which I already stated. But let me give you an idea of how we're going to proceed. So the nonlinear, again, we don't talk about gauge theories for now, but everything that we're going to say can be extended to gauge theories as well, supersymmetric gauge theories. So this nonlinear sigma model might have some global symmetries, okay? So it might have some global symmetries. What's important is that whatever the global symmetries are, so these global symmetries must be mute with my point for algebra. So this is a statement of Tolman-Mandola theorem. So I'm allowed to have global symmetries, but the global symmetries must be used with Poincaré symmetries. But now, when we have a supersymmetric extension, notice that we never talk about commutation of the global symmetries with a super Poincaré symmetry or with a supersymmetry. So global symmetries are not required to commute with supersymmetry or SUSY. So what this tells us that our supersymmetry generators might be charged under global symmetry. So what this means is that SUSY generators might, not necessarily must, but might be charged under these global symmetries. Okay, so a really important example of that is R symmetry. So let me introduce you a notion of an R symmetry. So it's a U1 symmetry. So we talked about Q1 R symmetry. It's a global symmetry. So in extended supersymmetry, so when we look, you know, the longer we talk, the less optimistic I am we will go to extended supersymmetry because of the lack of time. But so this R symmetry is abelian here. So in extended in extended 2C models, this R symmetry can become non-abelian. So an example of that is when we talk about n equal 2 supersymmetry, the R symmetry is going to be SU2. Now, in n equal 4 supersymmetry, you might have guessed that the R symmetry will be SU4. So it's a non-abelian symmetry. And those of you who have heard about ADS-CFT, so n equal 4 supersymmetric MNILs must be the same as a string theory in ADS-5 process 5. Right, so let me just say this commercial thing. So I have ADS-5 process 5. And if their correspondence work, it better be the case that all symmetries of the field theory somehow realized on the gravity side. So this 5 sphere has a symmetry S of 6. So the 5 sphere has S of 6 symmetry group. And it just so happened that the symmetry group of the 5 sphere on the gravity side is the R symmetry of the gate theory. And the reason for that, because it just so happened that as groups, SU4 is isomorphic to SO6. Okay. Actually, the ideas of looking at the symmetries on the field theory side and trying to ask how do we describe this field theory on the gravity side, so this has been very powerful, how you identify symmetries, and that's sort of the first step when you construct a gravitational dual. But for us, it's just U1R. So we'll talk about abelian gauge symmetries. Sorry, not gauge, abelian R symmetries. So how do we introduce it? Oh, so let's look back at the supersymmetry algebra. So I have Q alpha, Q bar alpha dot, closes on QP alpha alpha dot. Now, I know that the R charge, so this is the same as 2 sigma mu alpha alpha dot P mu. So I know that my Poincaré generators cannot carry any non-trivial global symmetry, right? So they, whatever charges they carry must commute with Poincaré group. So the easiest thing to do is to assign an R charge to P to be equal to zero. But then I can make something interesting if I assign an R charge to Q alpha to be equal to minus one. So this is just convention. So this is conventional normalization of U1R. So in general, whenever you have an abelian group, the charges doesn't have a natural normalization. It's only when one of the reasons why people try to embed an electromagnetic U1 into into non-abelian symmetry, because then you get a natural charge quantization of a U1, which is part of the non-abelian group. So, but standalone, there is no normalization. So we can normalize charges any way we want for a U1. And so the convention is you call the R charge as a Q, Q alpha minus 1. So I can make sense of this. The R charge of P mu will be equal to 0. If I'm going to assign an R charge to Q bar to be equal to plus 1. Okay, so then my algebra will work beautifully. So now once I make this charge assignment, you can see immediately that the supersymmetry generators actually do not commute with an odd charge generator. Probably shouldn't be using this. And this one as well. So what we're going to show now, we're going to show that R, if I think about R as an operator, then with those assignments, the commutator of R and Q alpha is minus Q alpha, and the commutator equals plus Q alpha bar. So this is what I was telling you, that this is not, if we have a global symmetry, they are required to commute with Poincaré generators. So Rp mu, the commutator equals to 0. So this is Kalman-Mandula theorem. But it doesn't require that they commute with the super Poincaré symmetries, and in particular the supercharges. So how can I see that? It's actually very trivial. So what I can do, I can look at this commutator, and I can act with the commutator on any state. So suppose I have an eigenstate. Do I need, of eigenstates, say, of the Hamiltonian of my system. And so I'm just going to look at R, Q alpha, commutator, acted on some state n. And I'm just going to assume that my state n is an eigenstate of R symmetry. So R, if I evaluate the R charge, it just gives me a little r. Okay? So if I act, so my n is an eigenstate of this operator. So this is the same as RQ alpha acted on N minus Q alpha R acted on N. Okay? And if the R charge of the state N is R, then the R charge, the R charge of Q alpha is this guy has minus 1, so I have the same what I had before, and I just have minus 1. Okay? And so here I have that this is minus 1 plus R. And then minus, I lost Q alpha. I still have a Q alpha active net. And then I have minus Q alpha R n, gives me R times n. And so that is minus Q alpha active on n. And that's exactly the same what the right hand side will do for you. All right, so very good. So let's continue. So what we can do, we can recall our
I can follow that step right there, where you are acting on operator Q times N. Why is it minus 1?
Why is this minus 1?
Yeah.
So So you have a state, so you have a product of two operators. Think of this as that there is an operator that creates. Okay, so the easiest thing is suppose that the vacuum, suppose that the vacuum is has an off charge zero, right? Now, in order for me to create the state n, I should act on the vacuum with some operator. So the off charge of that operator is r, little r. But now, on top of that, in order for me to look at this, so let me call this state n, operator n, acted on the vacuum will give me the state n. Right? So now, what I have here is this operator. Okay? So if I compute a global symmetry charge of a product of two operators, I just simply have to add the charges of each operator separately. Right, so I'm assuming that my state n is an eigenstate of r. Then this means that an r charge of n equals to little r. R charge of q alpha would normalize to be equal to minus 1. And then I have two operators, a product of them. So their charges simply add together. It's exactly the same. Let me give you. No, I cannot give you a simpler. I don't think I can give you a simpler example. Well, we'll see a little bit more complicated of this when. So there is a subtlety here, but I don't want to go into a subtlety, and that subtlety is not relevant in this context. So you have to worry about this procedure because
you can just use.
It would be exactly. Think of the mass dimension. Think of the dimension as a charge, right? So a dimension of the operator is, in some senses, also a charge. So if I have a product of two operators. Each one has a very specific scaling dimension. In fact, the scaling dimension of an operator is precisely a charge under the dilatation operator. So if I have a product of two operators, the scaling dimension simply add together, which is the statement that their charges under the dilatation operator would add together.
Actually, you can think about it more naively if you just think about the charge coming from a phase vector.
Yeah.
And a symmetry transformation. And so then you multiply two phase vectors, so you add the charge as an exponent. I mean, this is the standard U1 symmetry method charge
All right, so very good. So what I wanted to do is to continue with my half charge assignment. So again, this is just global charge. Everything that I'm saying implies that my R symmetry is an exact symmetry of a series. We will talk about this in a little bit. So again, R charge of Q alpha equals to minus 1. But then if I look at the super translation, right? So the super translation generators is del over del theta alpha minus I sigma mu alpha alpha dot theta bar alpha dot down here. And then there is a similar one for Q bar alpha dot. So this guy has an R charge minus 1. So this derivative must have an R charge of minus 1 as well. So this tells me that the R charge of theta alpha should be equal to plus 1. Okay? Because if it is plus 1, it's in the denominator, so it has a negative charge. Again, the easiest way to think of this is as Matt was saying is that think of this as a transformation under phase. So now the operator is in the denominator, so the phase change will be into the minus, whatever it was before. That's why I have to assign a charge plus one. Now, this guy doesn't have any charge, so it has charge zero under our symmetry. So the arc charge, I have to put it, the arc charge of theta bar, alpha dot, so it should be equal to minus one. So very good. Now, so remember that our Lagrangian has two pieces, right? So there is a calotron d4 theta, a calot potential, and then there is a superpotential d2 theta of w plus the emission conjugate, right? So we want to make our R symmetry an exact symmetry, at least classically. So the R charge. The arc charge of all of the tangent should be equal to zero. So I don't care about the Keller potential, because what we will be concentrated on are the superpotential terms. So what this tells me that the arc charge of this integral must be equal to zero. But d theta is the same as del over del theta. Like the Grassmann integral is the same as a Grassmannian derivative. So an R charge of d theta, right? So theta has an R charge plus one. So d theta will have an R charge of minus one. So an R charge of d2 theta is going to be equal to minus two. So what we discovered with you is that the R charge of a superpotential must be equal to positive. So if we have that, if we can manage to write down the superpotential and make our R charge assignment of the fields in the superpotential in such a way that our superpotential has an R charge plus two, then the R symmetry is an exact symmetry, at least classically. And if you think about it, that's all what matters. So let's think a little bit more about R symmetry. So suppose I have a chiral superfield, right? So this is an important thing. Different components of a chiral superfield will carry different R charges. And the way to see it is actually very straightforward. So suppose I have a chiral superfield, and this chiral superfield has an R charge little r. Okay? So if I think about this chiral superfield, so a chiral superfield is a function of y and theta, where y is x plus theta sigma theta bar. Okay, as you can see, I became very slow and stopped writing any indices whatsoever. So this guy has an expansion as a scalar field, right? Then plus root 2 theta psi. And then I have plus theta squared f. That's a component expansion of a chiral superfield. So this guy has an R charge R. Theta has an R charge plus one, right? So this tells me that psi must have an R charge R minus one, okay? And the auxiliary component in the chiral superfield will have an R charge R minus two. So all those fields are in a supersymmetry multiplet, but if there is an R symmetry, then they carry different charge assignment. So let me make it formal. So R of phi equals little r, R of psi equals R minus 1, and R of f equals R minus 2. So the next question is, can we always have, so as far as I talked up to now, you know, I said if there is an R symmetry, but the question is, can we always find an R symmetry? Does the R symmetry exist when we talk about some interesting interacting supersymmetric field series? So can we always find R symmetry? Meaning, can we always find an assignment of R charges to in our superpotential so that everything makes sense? So it turns out that this question is all very nice questions, has two answers, no and yes. So the answer is no, we cannot. If, and again, there will be an explicit example when you will see this exactly. So no, if couplings, right? So we used to think about couplings as some numbers. And so if you continue thinking about couplings as some numbers, if couplings are neutrals, so a hard charge of GI in our superpotential equal to zero, then the answer in general is no. But then it would make it a useless symmetry, right? And in fact, what Zeibert managed to do, in some sense, it was the whole big story that, you know, so much powerful results that there are no quantum correction. It stems from this very simple observation in that we can change the answer to no by saying it yes if we make the coupling carry some charge. Okay? So the answer is yes if couplings carry a non-zero charge. And moreover, within the next 10 minutes or so, you will understand why this is natural. Why it is natural to think about couplings as being charged, while not being field themselves.
So is it if all couplings are zero versus all couplings not zero? Or
you will see an explicit example that I will try to say my couplings, for example, a mass. It doesn't carry any electric charge. It doesn't carry any non-abelian charge. It doesn't carry any charge whatsoever. A mass is a mass, right? If you write down a coupling, and you call a coupling, normally you would say, oh, it's just, you know, it's just say a number. It doesn't carry any charge. So now what I'm saying is that there is a global symmetry. So if you continue insisting on the same thing, that whatever couplings you have, they are neutral under the global symmetry, then you cannot find out R symmetry in general. You will come to the inconsistencies, and you will see explicitly the inconsistency in example. You will start assigning R symmetries, and you find a contradiction, which means that you cannot find a consistent R charge assignment. On the other hand, if you allow this to happen, then this has a very long ramifications and very powerful ramifications.
So what you mean is that all couplings in your theory can't have?
Can't have. Some of them will have zero charge, but some of them will have a non-zero charge. And once you do that, then that's pretty much the thing that changed the way how people were thinking about supersymmetry. At least that's my impression. I don't think I want to say anything more on this page. Good. So example. So now we will do an example and we will see this yes and no, and in which sense yes is much more interesting than no. So a powerful idea should be possible to explain on simplest examples. And that's indeed, I think, what was done first time. So what we're going to do, we're going to look at the simplest Bazzolino model. So there is a single field. And so those are the, this is the superpotential. So phi is chiral superfield, and this is the superpotential. So what we do know about our symmetry. So first, we will give the answer no. How does no will come from? Well, what do we know? We know that my superpotential must have an arc charge plus 2. I told you what is an R symmetry, how we normalize it, and once we know how we normalize it, then we cannot change this fact. And then I told you that the answer to this question is no when we say that R charges of all couplings in a superpotential are zero. So then the answer is trivial, right? So I look at this term, and I know that an R charge of M phi squared, it's equal as an R charge of M plus twice an R charge of my chiral superfield phi. And then this thing must be equal to 2. So in order for this first term to have, as a term in the superpotential, to have an R charge plus 2, I have to conclude that an R charge of the field phi must be equal plus 1. But then I can look at this second term, which is an interaction. So the interaction term must also have an R charge plus 2. But my coupling doesn't have any charge, right? So we made an assumption that my coupling doesn't have any charge. So the only way how I can satisfy this is to say that my chiral superfield has a charge, 2/3. But it cannot have two assignments. That's what I was telling you, that you will find an inconsistency. So one term in a superpotential requires a chiral superfield to carry a charge plus 1, but then there is another term in a superpotential which requires a chiral superfield to carry charge 2/3. This is impossible. That's why the answer to this question is no. But the answer immediately changes to yes. So the answer changes to yes. If I'm going to say that R charge of lambda equals to minus 1, then I can still say that an R charge of M equals to 0. R charge of my chiral superfield equals plus 1. And then this is a consistent charge assignment. Okay? So this is consistent. R charge assignment. So you can say, well, it doesn't make any sense. How can a coupling carry a charge? And you're right. The coupling cannot carry the charge. But the way to think about this is not to think of this as a coupling. So what we can do, we can assume, so this Bazzolino superpotential that I wrote down there is a renormalizable. But it doesn't necessarily mean that I have to think of this as a complete series, right? So much like in our example with a little H field, it might be just still an effective potential. So what I can do, I can assume that that superpotential is an effective superpotential. And so which is valid below some energy scale. And in fact, what I can think of, I can assume that that the correct superpotential, so this is an effective superpotential, m phi squared plus lambda phi to the cube, this is just an effective superpotential. But the correct superpotential, the one that involves at high energies, right, it has extra field. And so what could happen is that the correct one, as far as this field phi concerned, for example, has this, but then this term is not lambda phi to the cube, but some cubic coupling of this type, where chi is additional field. And then there are some other terms that does not involve, so there is no phi dependence here. There are some other dynamics. So this extra field chi might have some other interactions. I don't care about that. Now, if this is a correct, better way to say it, microscopic. If this is microscopic or high energy superpotential, what could happen? Well, first of all, suppose, okay, let me just continue this. So there is this microscopic superpotential, and suppose there is a dynamics, field chi is massive, and has some interesting dynamics. Some of the models of this type we will write down later, okay? But suppose there is some interesting dynamics, and what happened is that in a vacuum, the expectation value of this field is not equal to zero. So again, the example that should be in your mind is the example that we had earlier today, like this one. So there is an interesting dynamics, and the field phi condensed into some value, and so there is an expectation value. So what I'm saying that what we can think of is that is just an effective superpotential, and the correct coupling involves this cubic coupling. And moreover, what I can say is that suppose the expectation value of my new superfield type is lambda, then from the effective field theory perspective, I will not see that it's a field. I will see that this is just a constant. But this constant is secretly an expectation value of the field. Now, there is no problem. Nothing will, you will have no problem if I am saying that I have a new field, and this new field has an R charge minus one. You say, OK, fine, it's just a field. So of course, it can carry a charge. But now notice that if the field carries a charge, then its expectation value will carry exactly the same charge. So what I am saying is that if we think about couplings in our superpotential as an expectation value of chiral superfield, then it is natural to assign them charges, like we did here. Yes?
But doesn't that put very strong constraints on what can be a like UV complete theory?
No. It's actually, I can make it infinitely many. It doesn't have, it doesn't make any constraints. All what I'm required is that there is a, think of it this way, okay? What I care is that there is a dynamic that tells me that this vacuum is unstable, and then there is a stable vacuum away from the origin of the place, right? But how does my potential behave in this way, or the way how I wrote, doesn't really matter. So the UV completion, what you're talking about this aspect. How does potential behave at very, very large values of the field? I don't care about that. All I care is that there is some nice non-trivial feature in the potential that forces me the field to be displaced from the origin.
Well, I just thought that the number of theories which you can write down with coupling constants that have zero R charge and consistent R charge assignment is smaller than the.
I would say there is only one theory from the ones that you look at. You can see that it's only the pretty much the mass transition right now.
Yes. So yeah. That's what I said. You're pretty constrained about which
yes, that's why. That's why then the R symmetry would be completely useless too.
Yeah.
But now what I'm saying, and you will see, because what we are going, I'm leading you towards Seebeck way of thinking pretty much, and that will ultimately lead us to very strong statements that there are no quantum corrections. So the step that he made is he was thinking about couplings as the expectation values of some fields. It doesn't really matter what those fields are. What matters is that, again, the reason why it doesn't matter because you don't think of this. You don't think of this as a full theory valid to arbitrary high energy. You think of this only as an effective theory, which is something that you have to do anyway when we talk about nonlinear sigma model. So he said, why don't we be entirely honest and take that at the face value? Think of this as an effective field theory, but once I say that it's an effective field theory, then I cannot claim that that's a number. It might very well be an expectation value of the field. As long as I ask questions which I can ask correctly in the context of effective field theory, I will not make a mistake by thinking that that's a value of the field. That's all he said. Before I ask you, you had a question.
Oh, I was just saying, so this is basically any spontaneous symmetry breaking where the vacuum picks up a charge.
Right. Yeah.
So, but your microscopic theory needs to have consistent R charge.
Yeah, it will. Yeah. So you can see this. You know, I'm assuming that I can add, in principle, infinite number of fields, as many as I want.
So the same way that you can make a consistent arbitrary assignments for
a single field, but I can make it consistent.
A single field.
I can make so that from this perspective, the way how I circumvented this problem by saying that I have more than one field.
Right.
In fact, what I did, I was thinking about lambda as being a field. Well, by in this case, it's, well, strictly speaking, I should think of this as an expectation value. Right, guys?
So, okay. So the problem is when you have self-interactions.
No, because whenever you start introducing self-interactions, the coupling in those self-interactions, I can think about fields and keep making charge assignments that everything is consistent.
Right,
correct? Okay. So I'm going to go give you an argument. So this residential model has this potential, a superpotential. And so what we're going to prove with you is that if we include all possible quantum corrections in the residential model, then I'm going to write down the statement that we are proving, that we're going to prove with you within the next 15 minutes, hopefully. So we started with this W, and I'm just going to call this, if you wish, classical. So our classical superpotential takes this form. What I'm going to say, I'm going to prove to you the W quantum, which includes all possible, so lambda is an interaction coupling, right? So the interactions are encoded in lambda, as you know. So this theory is renormalizable, so you know there can be all possible correction. But I'm going to prove to you that the quantum superpotential, including all perturbative and non-perturbative corrections, takes this form. So all corrections are taken care of. It's exactly the same numbers, F, lambda, as it is here and here. But this, of course, this was a very powerful statement, and so people said, but come on, if I write down my potentials, there are loop corrections. And so that's when I was telling you that people went ahead and computed 1, 2, 3, 4, I don't know when they stopped. But they found that indeed, there are corrections coming from bosons and fermions, loop corrections, but if you add all together, so the intermediate steps, you get a very messy result, and you think there are corrections, but at the end of the day, when you add everything together, you will find out that there are no corrections. So the claim is that this statement is an exact statement. And that's an example of non-renormalization theorem. So let's prove it.
So,
So the trick is to try to find a bunch of global symmetries. So quantum, whatever this quantum superpotential is, WQ, well, one thing is that you have to make an assumption. So that there is, well, it depends on the chiral superfield, phi. In principle, this phi is not the same as the one phi that is up there. Okay? So, strictly speaking, I should have put a hat here. Okay, but, and it depends on the coupling, and it depends on masses. Okay, so whatever the quantum corrections will make it depend on these guys. Well, I'm not going to put hats because I will keep forgetting putting them anyway. So the thing is that we'll go back and we will talk what's the relation of these phi to the phi up there. Okay? But the quantum superpotential just depends on this. And so what we're going to do, we're going to require that it's invariant under the same, under the global symmetries that the original one was invariant under. So in other words, we are making assumptions that, well, first of all, SUSY is unbroken. And global symmetries are not anomalous. Now, the next step, and this is a crucial step here. Remember, there is this coupling lambda, but even if I start thinking about a U1R symmetry, for example, global symmetries, I really meant multiple, because there will be several symmetries that we will have to talk about here. But in particular, one of them is an R symmetry. And this R symmetry already requires us to think of lambda as an expectation value of some auxiliary chiral superfield. Okay. Now, here comes a very important thing. So if lambda is an expectation value of an auxiliary chiral superfield, what is lambda bar? The lambda bar is an expectation value of the expectation value of the anti-chiral superfield. But the superpotential, and here comes the most important thing, is that the superpotential W can depend only on chiral superfields. It cannot depend on anti-chiral superfields. So the instance we said that our couplings are expectation values of some chiral superfields, it immediately tells me that del W over del lambda bar must be equal to zero. So in this, in the superpotential is a complex quantity. So coupling can be complex. M and lambda is complex. So the fact that I'm thinking now about couplings as expectation value of chiral superfields, they cannot depend on the anti-chiral superfield. And the formal way to say it is that whatever my quantum superpotential is, it must depend holomorphically on lambda. That's the issue of holomorphicity in supersymmetry. So whatever the couplings are, so let me write it out. So there are two statements here. Statement one is couplings in superpotential are complex. So that's the first statement. Second statement is that W is holomorphic in these couplings. So a formal way to say it in the context of our model, whatever the quantum corrections are, they are such that this is true.
Yeah. So is it all possible couplings can be complex are just ones that come from expectation values.
But we can think about any coupling as coming from the expectation.
But not the mass term, right?
Mass term as well.
The mass term as well? Okay.
Sure.
So the mass term can be complex as well? Then, right?
Well, in that case, yes, because again, the superpotential, it's not really the mass term.
Okay.
So if you think about, suppose I would have this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the potential that would come from a superpotential would be this.
Okay.
Right, so what you will get an absolute value of m squared.
Okay.
So m itself can be complex, and that's the way how you have to think of them. You have to think of them as a complex, and that allows you to use a complex analysis instead of normal analysis. And complex analysis is much more restrictive. So in particular, the superpotential, that's why the superpotential, remember, was an integral over half of a superspace. And the reason we managed to write it down as a supersymmetric term in the action, because we were thinking of this as a chiral supercube. So anything that is in a superpotential must be chiral. But now what I'm saying is that all the couplings are expectations value of the chiral supercube. So chiral is the same as holomorphic. So this is a big slogan, chiral. Chiral is the same in this language as holomorphic. And anti-chiral is anti-homomorphic. Okay. So let's. So this looks very simple. And you might think, okay, what will it buy us? Well, actually, it buys us quite a lot. So we already know that. For example, the R charge, a consistent assignment is that one consistent assignment is to assign an R charge of lambda to be -1, right, in this model. So suppose that this quantum superpotential, naively, if I wouldn't think of these couplings as being chiral supercube, well, I would have said that those guys are complex. So they would depend on all this stuff. And now what I'm going to do, I'm just going to do an expansion in terms of operators. So it's a sum of all operators. And I'm just going to look at the operator which has an index 10. Okay, so in front of this, there is a function of lambda and lambda bar. I'll just concentrate on these two. So this 10 means that the R charge of this operator, over 10, so this operator is some combination of fields, something that comes due to quantum correction. I don't know what it is, and honestly, I don't care. The only thing I do know is that this guy is plus, right? So it enters as an additive term in my superpotential. So it must have an R charge. All this together must have an R charge +2. So what I'm saying that I look at the field, so it's made out of field. So this guy has, I'm going to say that it has, say, an R charge +10. Then in order for the total combination to have an R charge +2, I know that the R charge of this arbitrary function that depends on the coupling must be equal to -8. Okay? Actually, let me make it a little bit different, because this will make me say more words than I want to say. So I'm going to put it -10 there, and then the R charge of the coupling is +8. So now what we're going to do with you, we're going to ask the question. So how does, in principle, it could be any function, right? So there are interactions, there are arbitrary quantum corrections. So,
yeah.
Can we do that?
Sorry?
Then we give an overall -2.
Yeah, -2.
-2, so because this must be +12. Let's make it +12. So the thing is, what are the possible terms here? I know what charge my lambda has, right? So R charge of lambda equals -1. R charge of minus lambda. Is it minus one? Okay, see, now I really want to, I keep switching, so I want it to be a minus 8. You will see why I am switching it. So this guy is minus 1, and the R charge of lambda bar is plus 1. Okay, so this guy, R charge of F, equals to minus 8. So one term is going to be lambda to the 8. So in principle, you could have said, wait a minute, but I can have other terms here. So I can have, for example, maybe suppose this is to whatever, I don't know, 8 loop order, you get a correction of the type lambda to the 8. But maybe if you do computation to the 10th order, you will get lambda to the 10. And then you want to make sense of this. So I want to make the all R charts to be equal to minus 8. So I would need to put lambda bar square. Okay? And then somebody very smart will come and say, but this is just a perturbative series. And there can be many more things. So in particular, there could be a non-perturbative correction. There could be something like an instanton correction. And something like an instanton correction can be something like this. So all these contributions, all the terms in this function, they have the correct R chart. Okay? So without holomorphicity, and this will be the last thing I will say, without holomorphicity, anything goes here. And in fact, if you were to do a non-supersymmetric field theory and ask this question in a non-supersymmetric field theory, you will find out that in principle, all terms of this type will be generated. Now, a supersymmetry tells me that whatever this function is after the quantum correction, then it must be a holomorphic function. It cannot depend on lambda bar. And then you can ask, how can I make this while preserving the R charge A of this term? Well, this guy goes away, this guy goes away. So as long as you have only one coupling constant lambda, there is nothing else you can write down. Okay, so the claim is that holomorphicity tells you that the only term, so whatever, if you have an operator on 10, then this operator can be multiplied only by lambda to the 8 and nothing else. Because anything else you will write down containing lambda, in order for you to satisfy the R symmetry, that would have to contain lambda bar, and that's not possible because that must be a holomorphic. All right, guys, we're being kicked out, so we'll continue on Thursday.